From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 2014 in Rochester's Inner Loop. 7 years ago, the city began filling in the eastern third of the Inner Loop, clearing the way for both new development and a reconnection of city neighborhoods that had been divided by sunken highway. According to the city of Rochester, filling in the eastern third cost about $25 million. And 2 years ago, they floated a plan to fill in the northern part of the loop, but the cost estimates were around $100 million. Where would the money come from? WXXI's James Brown, writing for City News, for City Magazine, has one potential answer. The Biden administration has proposed more than $2 trillion for infrastructure work across the country. That money is intended not only to rebuild roads and bridges, it's intended to heal some of the harm done when so many predominantly black communities were torn apart by so-called urban renewal 50 and 60 years ago. So who decides what would go in that space? As Brown reports, it's an area the size of roughly 16 football fields. There's a lot that could happen there, and some neighbors are concerned that they might be left out of the process. So let's talk about it this hour. My guests include James Brown, reporter for WXXI News, in studio with us for the first time in a long time. Nice to see you, my friend.
Good to see you too, Evan.
Also with us on the phone is Nancy Hernandez-Mishuska, who is a Marketview Heights neighbor and a member of the Lewis Street Committee. Nancy, thanks for being on the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Suzanne Mayer is president of Hinge Neighbors. Suzanne, welcome to you. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you. Delighted to be here.
In a moment, you'll hear some sound that we have on tape of Mayor Lovely Warren, Norman Jones from the city of Rochester, talking about where things stand with this. But James, you know, when I go back to 2014, that was the first year I hosted the show. My goodness, the phone calls we got when people heard about filling the interloop, it was either, yes, you must do this, or I think my favorite phone call I got, somebody called and said, this is a travesty. You can't fill this. I love using that road when I go to work. Nobody's ever on it. I thought, that's a pretty good argument for filling the thing in anyway if we're just looking at traffic usage. But James, when you have been reporting on this particular part of the project, 7 years ago it was imminent that the eastern third was going to happen. How imminent is this next part? I mean, is in your view, is this definitely going to happen?
I wouldn't say definitely. I would say plausible.
Plausible.
Yes. The city seems determined to move toward this as a conclusion. But I wouldn't say imminent. I would say maybe 3-4 years out at the closest.
But your reporting indicates that Mayor Warren has told neighborhood groups that this is not necessarily 3-4 years away.
Yes.
That we could get this thing done in months.
Not done in its entirety. But development in the neighborhoods itself.
That's a big, big statement, though, isn't it?
Yes, it absolutely is.
Very ambitious statement.
Very ambitious statement, and the city had no rebuttal.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this is a project that would cost a lot more than the last time around. In fact, your reporting indicates that that the city puts a big range on this, right? Something like $70 million at the low end, a couple hundred million at the high end?
Yeah, $250 million, yes, at the higher end.
Why is it such a huge range?
The argument was that they don't know exactly what they would build yet. One of the ideas was potential of a tunnel. There's still about 8,000 cars that go through there every day. So the idea of sort of having an underground transportation and then have building on top of it. So that'd be the more expensive part of it. Also, we're talking a lot more land in comparison.
To comparison to the eastern third?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so it's a bigger space. So all of those reasons, there's a wide range of possibilities on what they do with it, how they use it, if they keep the cars underground or if they fill it in entirely and compact it. So it's a big range of possibilities.
Totally.
They're pretty confident that they can get a lot of this money from the Biden administration's infrastructure plan?
I think overly so, but they're optimistic about
sure.
It for sure.
Yeah, I mean, the Transportation Secretary, Pete Buttigieg, has said many times that this country has to grapple with its history, and its often racist history, of transportation issues that have torn apart communities. I can't really think of a better example than this, right? I mean, your reporting takes us there, too. Norm Jones himself talked about this. You might have been in awe of this as a kid 50 years ago, as he talked about 50, 60 years ago, watching it happen. But what ended up happening, this is on the list of projects that clearly had an impact on communities that were primarily black communities, right?
Precisely. And Jones himself said that it was a mistake, that this was, that I believe the quote I'll be using is that it ripped out some of the arteries, the main drivers of those neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
And they haven't quite been repaired at any point in its history.
I'm looking forward in a moment. We're going to talk to Nancy and Suzanne about how they see the proposals. And when I say proposals, I mean, we're not all that far along in that, to James's point, we don't exactly know what's going to go there yet. But just the idea of utilizing the space, mm-hmm. what they want to see there, if they have specific ideas or if there's certain things that they really don't want to see. I don't know if the city needs more high-end housing. It seems like every time there's new space, there's talk of high-end housing. And we'll talk about that in a moment. But let's listen to what some city leaders had to say. Our first example of this is the mayor, Lovely Warren, talking about neighborhoods, gentrifying neighborhoods. And I think this starts with you asking a question, James Brown.
Yes. I asked her specifically, how can you invest in a neighborhood to the degree that they're thinking about it and not gentrify it?
All right. So let's listen to that question. We'll get the answer too. Go ahead.
Is it possible to gentrify a neighborhood without forcing the neighbors out? Because that's the chief concern that I've heard from neighbors so far.
I don't want to gentrify a neighborhood. I think that we have to be very intentional about what you want to see in the community. And that's why speaking with and engaging neighbors and understanding their fears and their concerns, right? If you look at what we did in the Interloop East, you know, you have market rate homes for sale, townhomes at $300,000 plus. You have market rate housing that are for rental, you know, at upwards of $1,100. But you also have housing for affordable housing, you know, where some people are paying $200 a month for rent. And so you diversify income and you diversify people and you make sure that you're intentional about doing that by the projects that you select to go there. And I think that that is one of the chief concerns of the equity agenda. And that's why we're pushing with the AIR agenda, really housing and allowing for that to be a major option for those people that are lower income to now buy. And so we're in discussions on modular homes. We're in discussions when we talk to the neighbors, especially the Market View Heights neighbors, they want more single family homes. And we want to be able to allow, you know, those people that are maybe below 60% of the AMI that would not get a typical mortgage, be able to access and be in the market to be able to buy a home and build wealth for them and their families. And you have to be intentional about that. That is not something that you think about after the fact. That's something that as you're designing, as you're selecting projects, that is at the forefront of your mind. And that's what you provide the options for builders to be able to build there.
That's Mayor Lovely Warren talking to James Brown. And I think the last few last little bit of those remarks is important, James, when she says you've got to be intentional. You know, you have to know exactly what you're doing here and follow through right from the start. Because otherwise, it probably goes in the direction that so much development does. She even talked about the eastern third of the Interloop's got townhomes that are $300,000 plus, got rent at apartments, $1,100 and up, some much higher than that.
Many must so. They're higher than that.
I mean, 1,500, 1,600 more. And you wonder what the saturation point is in this city. I don't know. I don't have the answer for that, but I don't know that the northern part of the Interloop needs more of that.
Well, the city actually in their study gave a little bit of an inkling to that. Actually, the development there, they don't expect to need much more housing in the city due to our population decline over the next few decades. Yet they are certain, dead certain, on creating a lot more housing, largely because of concerns about the housing stock. And as she mentioned, modular housing, sort of giving people with lower incomes more opportunities. One of the things that I did ask her as well was about how much of this is about taxes and increasing our tax base, because homeowners actually pay into the toll to keep the city going. And she was effusive. She said that, hell no, this was not about taxes. This is about giving opportunities, about trying to build people up. Whether that's true or not, I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. It looks, from my perspective, it seems like wanting a little bit of both. Trying to get more people actually paying taxes and potentially building people up at the same time.
So let's talk to Nancy and Suzanne about this. So Nancy, let me start with you. You know, you heard what the mayor had to say about what might go on these 22 acres, 16 football fields. Do I have that right, James? Is that correct?
Yes.
I mean, that's a lot of space there. What do you make of what the mayor was just saying about that, Nancy?
Well, I sort of agree with the mayor on a third of what she was saying, that we do need housing available to be able to, families to be able to participate in buying their own homes and raising their families back into our neighborhood. Affordable is one of the main things that we're looking at. What's going on is when they're building these rental units, their prices are so high. It's even low. It's lower to be able to pay a mortgage on a home than being able to live in these rental units that they built.
Yep.
You know, so one of the main things that impacts our neighborhood is that a lot of these young people nowadays are interested in buying homes, but there isn't any homes for them to be able to participate in buying. It's not a point of where it's located is leaving your neighborhood. They want to be able to buy homes in their own neighborhood and where they were raised and feel safe at. And we really don't have that in our neighborhood, because if you go around, all you see is rental units, and we don't need any more of those. Mm-hmm. We want to be able to buy our own homes and raise our families in our neighborhood. And that's an option that we don't have.
So, Nancy, when you look at the eastern third of the Inner Loop, where that work started 7 years ago, and some of the things the mayor is talking about, and some of the rental units you just mentioned, is that sort of a red flag for you? Is that a warning that, are you concerned that that could happen again where you are?
Definitely. We are very concerned about that. If you really look at it, it's like creating a wall of buildings and rental units to hide our neighborhood. And it was already affected by taking away all our businesses away when they did the Inner Loop. And we lost a lot out of our community here because of that. And we want to be able to claim that back and say, hey, this is part of our neighborhood, and we want to make sure that when you go to build and develop your projects that you have in mind in our neighborhood, we want to be a part of it and be involved in the process, so that way we can help you vision what we see. It's really difficult to accept them building all these high-cost rental units in our neighborhood that we can't afford to live in. We can't even take part in living. We can only glance and look at them and imagine how they look inside. You know, it's just something that wasn't considered for us normal, regular resident people. Mm.
In a moment, I'll take our first phone call. John in Rochester, hang there for just one more second. And listeners, if you want to contribute to the conversation here, the email address is connections@wxxi.org. You can call the program toll-free. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. It's 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. Suzanne Mayer, what do you make of this sort of blank canvas that the city is about to have, potentially?
It's quite a campus, to tell you the truth. I believe that what we're going to see is the feasibility study here is about the transportation study. And the consultants are about ready to show us five different alternatives that they're proposing for how the streets are going to be designed if, in fact, the filling goes in. I suspect we're going to see that in June. We've been told that instead of a December deadline for deciding what the streets are going to look like, we're going to see it in September. And I suspect part of that is because we're trying to go to Washington and get a lot of that infrastructure money. And you have to have a shovel-ready sort of plan before you can go to Washington. So I understand and appreciate the moving of that. What that makes our job, which is Hinge Neighbors, our job is to make sure that neighborhoods are responding. We've been working very hard to get people to understand this is going to happen, most likely. This is going to affect the neighborhoods, and how are you going to influence what's happening? So luckily enough, we met Nancy and a few other people from the Lewis Street Committee, and that has been very positive. They actually said, we want to present to the mayor. We did help make a presentation so that they could make that. We've worked with School 58. We've worked with some business people to talk about this is coming, be prepared, get ready to give your opinions. And also we've worked with a Grove Place, which is the fairly wealthy area on the other side of the moat. To a T, most of them say we don't want more buildings so that we create a wall instead of a moat. We want to bring our neighborhoods together. And in fact, when talking with Nancy, they talk about the fact that the 16th Ward was there and then it was destroyed. One of my jobs right now is to go to the library and find out who was living there and what happened. And it is really amazing when you look at 1959, you see all these streets, 1960, some of the streets are gone, 1961, there are a lot more streets gone. And it was like watching a domino effect of these neighborhoods, this neighborhood that was destroyed. And we are reading the names of people. It's an eye-opening experience. What we want to make sure is that people have a voice to say, this is what should happen here, and it shouldn't be just large buildings. Let's be creative. There is a lot of talk about having green space around School 58. And School 58 says, and if you talk to the students, they are terrifically involved. And we said, well, how are you, you can talk about School 58, but you also have to talk about how School 58 relates to the community, because it's a school that has not necessarily done that. And so yesterday, we actually took a tour of the area with a group of seventh graders. We were outside walking, and they were inside a classroom watching us and having this discussion. So we think the youth should be involved, and they think so too. And I think the worst thing that we're worried about is displacement, just as Nancy says. And displacement can happen, preventions for that can happen at the federal level when the feds decide to give us this money. I suspect they're going to put in some sort of this is what you must do in order to get this money. Now, that could be in terms of land trust, or it could be in terms of other things that people who know far more about reparations and they're much more creative than I are talking about. And if we can work with all the people who can influence how this is really spent, I think we'll really make a really great impression for the rest of the nation. We actually led filling in the east side, and we learned so much from doing that. There were a lot of things right, but as Nancy said, they built a bigger wall. And if you walk down there, as I do a lot, all you see is this big wall. There's not even green space in between the walls to go to connect the units, although of the neighborhoods, although Richmond is now, Shalott is across the street.
Yeah, I just want to say to that point, James Brown, exactly what Suzanne's talking about. I mean, I was down that area just recently, and it used to be that you could, walk up and down, Pitkin, Union, and see a lot. And now a lot of that new construction, it's an interesting way of putting a little parallel, as Suzanne just did. The Inner Loop has long been a moat that divided. But if you just now build a wall that divides of just all new construction, it's still sort of a dividing line. It's different, but has some similar qualities. James, how much does green space come up when you're talking to people?
A lot.
Yeah.
Both in neighbors and both with the city government as well. They claim that they are invested in making sure there are places that people can share throughout whatever this ends up looking like. Mm-hmm. In particular, Warren mentioned from the Lewis Street presentation, the idea of center medians in streets to slow down traffic. She liked that idea. So I would presume in where we're going that would be included definitely.
Let me grab a phone call. This is John in Rochester, who in the past, we've talked about these issues, have had some really thoughtful things to say about some of these intertwining issues here. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hey, Evan. Hey, James. At the risk of becoming that guy with the one idea around gentrification, one thing that Keisha Lance Bottoms proposed in Atlanta was to mitigate the harm from heating up neighborhoods, so that the idea is to draw a circle around a neighborhood where there's a lot of market pressure driving up house prices, and the harm then is that you've got people on fixed incomes that, because their neighbors' houses are going for a lot of money, then they get hit hard with really high tax assessments, and so now they're paying a lot more for taxes. And so the simple public policy application for that is just like have a tax assessment freeze for people with fixed incomes in a neighborhood that's heating up by X percent. So you just create a formula, figure out a way to draw a circle around a neighborhood, and you can, you know, help out people who are potentially hurt by the harm. And the other thing is, yeah, it's really interesting to hear, you know, what the census is going to tell us about the next few years. And me and my wife drive downtown, and we're like, these are a lot of houses. Are we going to really fill? Is this going to work? Mm-hmm. And, you know, how much housing? So to the point of keeping young families in neighborhoods, if we are actually going to try to move forward and do infill and build affordable new homes, James, I was just wondering, is there any talk in City Hall about modular or manufactured homes, which are cheaper by a lot, and then there's net zero options around there now, although, you know, if you've got heat, that doesn't help you because it costs more, but it saves more. Is that even a possibility?
In the soundbite, actually, that we played earlier, Warren mentioned that modular homes specifically. And yes, that is definitely one of the things that are being considered. I asked him specifically about building new housing because typically when you build new housing, prices are through the roof to buy something new and outright. The idea is definitely on the table. Tax abatements were actually something that were brought up by the Lewis Street Committee. I believe Michael Paul mentioned it in the conversation with city government. I haven't followed up with them on that specifically, but that was something that he mentioned specifically about reparations.
And what was the mechanism of the tax abatement? Like, what's their idea of what that would do? Like, what is that about? When they say tax abatement, what do they mean?
I don't have too many details on that. That might actually be a better question for Nancy.
Yeah.
Hang there for a second, John. Nancy, do you know anything about this?
Not much about it. I know that so far as the taxes are going up in our community, it's something that's going to truly affect our neighborhood and our community, because a lot of us have fixed incomes, like you said, and a lot of us have minimum wage jobs. And yes, it would affect us highly when you're talking about taxes. We want to be able to have homes, and this is one of the things that we discussed. How is it going to affect us so far as taxes? If they build single homes and we have more green space because it's more of a luxurious looking area after they build on it and decide to have more green space around these homes, is that going to affect all the other people in our neighborhood? Are they going to be able to afford the taxes? Because no matter what you put on there, and it depends if it's businesses or it's homes, whatever, it's definitely going to affect us so far as taxes.
Yeah. And
it's something that we can't get out of.
Sure. And so, to John, I just want to say, first of all, people in the community know that you've got more than just one idea. But, if you want to keep pushing this one idea, from my perspective, it is the wisest proposal I have heard to actually address gentrification. So I want to stress again what John's talking about. He's pointing to the city of Atlanta, which has pursued policies that would put a cap on how much your taxes can rise in any given amount of time. And as John mentioned, there's probably lots of different formulas you could use. I mean, government could set anything it wants. But the idea is that you don't want to dissuade jobs, investment, but you don't want to push people out of neighborhoods, especially with how fast prices are moving. And so, I want to thank you for continuing to call our attention to that, John. And we actually, when this program ends, we're gonna see if we can get somebody from Atlanta on the line with us for a future program, because I want to talk more about this. I don't know why more cities aren't doing exactly what you just said. Having said all that, John, I'm sure you look around this city, the prices are nuts right now. We've done a couple of shows on this, and people are they can't keep up. I mean, we're seeing people bid 80 to 100 over asking, and I'm not talking about $500,000 homes. I'm talking about homes that sold for 150 a decade ago, and now they're going for 3+. It is hard to figure out where else this goes. And my concern, John, as someone who does live in the city of Rochester, as I do, is I don't know how. It sort of feels like too late. There's a lot of policies that might address some of this, but this is all already happening in a lot of different city neighborhoods, don't you think?
The heat would tend to point to the possibility of that we could build some more and more people mm-hmm. would come in. Mm-hmm. So that's the optimistic side of the census sadness. But I would just add, as an organizer, if you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail. But the gardens of Market View Heights are, just like an incredible, you drive up and down Union and even next to the old elementary school over there. That happened because Pam Rees Smith was, paid to be an organizer in that neighborhood. Actually, Pat Stone invested in that. And so whatever we do, we should also be investing in people to do the community building and working to knock on doors and connect people to each other to facilitate these conversations, but not just in short-term charrettes, but in a long-term way that really helps create social bridging and social capital, and I hate those words, but they're real.
I appreciate it, John. Thanks for the phone call, and thanks for keeping a light on this. I really do appreciate that.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, John. And so we're talking about filling in the inner loop, and not everyone agrees on what to do with development. I mean, here's Jason Haremza, who has been on a number of conversations on this program, very active in the urbanist community, and he disputes the idea that a wall is a problem. He says the idea of a wall of buildings dividing the city is ridiculous. That's what cities are, streets lined with buildings. Nobody looks at Main Street downtown and says, oh, it's lined with buildings. It's a wall that divides the city. I mean, Jason is technically right. Jason is technically right about that. There's a big difference between a moat of an inner loop and new land with buildings on it. I think I'm simply saying, maybe, Suzanne, you raised this, so I think the reason that your comments rang so true to me is once you actually fill the inner loop, it takes a while before development gets there, And people right. start to envision what it might look like if you didn't throw a bunch of buildings on there, if you had parks and space for families and kids and all kinds of things. And maybe that's just an idealist in me, but when you see that for 4, 5, 6 years, and then all of a sudden you do start to throw buildings on there, it does start to feel kind of walled off and divided again, though I take Jason's point. What do you think, Suzanne?
I think I understand. I know Jason quite well, and I understand what he's saying, that that's what a city is. But also, if you look, listen to Norman Garrick, who is a transportation expert, he says you can define what kind of a city you are, whether you're a mid-sized city mm-hmm. or you're maybe large. We're not New York, but we can be smart about how we do design this and be creative. I think that we people are saying, let's be creative about this. Do we want some four-story building? Sure. Down towards the more area, if you look at the infill, if you look at towards Cumberland and Post Office and St. Paul's, there are already large buildings there. So great, let's concentrate on putting large buildings there. That's the city's aspect. But if you're talking about the area where there are more residents involved, let's listen to the residents and say, what are they saying to us? They're saying, we want to have a community again, and we want to have this. You'll hear from Nancy, I think. This is the 16th Ward. It was a beautiful place to live. And if you talk to the community, they'll say, we love our community. We have a beautiful park. We want to improve it, but we also want to be able to buy land here. The question is, there is no land for sale there that they can buy now. And as you were saying, like, what's going to happen in the next few years? Because people are already, what I would say, Mikkel Powell has said, they're trying to hoard land. And that means not sell it to anybody because they're anticipating the price is going to go up. For instance, recently there have been like 4 or 5 houses that were sold on Lyndhurst. And the neighborhood really thought that was going to be great. And Nancy, maybe you can speak about this better than I. That would be, I think I'll turn it over to Nancy.
Yes, we were looking, we have some families and community members that are looking for homes to be able to move into and buy and stay in our immediate neighborhood. And these houses from David Gant's houses, they went up for sale, but the starting price on one of them was over $92,000, and the other homes were over $100,000. Dollars, and that is something that we couldn't afford. And then when we found out about it, they were all going as a unit, and they were all being sold all at one time. They didn't even include the neighborhood or the community to be able to know that these houses were going to go up for sale. Who did they sell them to? We have no idea. And was it somebody else that's ordering homes that are in our neighborhood? And there's plenty of agencies that are buying off these houses and renting them for high prices. And if you don't get Section 8 or get help from other places, you're not able to rent. So our community now is changing, and they're forcing us out little by little. And that's our main concern. When these, when they fill in, to be able to envision a park there for the kids to be able to play in, a water park, and to be able to have homes so these low-cost income families could be able to afford.
Talking to Nancy Hernandez-Mashuska, who is a Market View Heights neighbor and a member of the Lewis Street Committee. Suzanne Mayer is with us, the president of Hinge Neighbors, and James Brown, a reporter for WXXI News, who has done a deep dive into the future of the northern part of the Interloop, which could see potentially $100 million or more to fill it and to develop it in a lot of different ways. So a lot of possibilities here. And after we take this only break, we're going to come back, and James has some sound from Norman Jones from the city of Rochester talking about community engagement and the value of making sure that people like Nancy and Suzanne and others are not only at the table, but not sort of just at the table for, to use a phrase that a listener used, sort of tokenizing. I mean, like, this is real work with communities. So we'll do that on the other side of this only break. Coming up in our second hour, a conversation about bees and what they're carrying. They're not just pollinating. Research indicates bees are carrying all kinds of microplastics, a harbinger of what is happening to our world and what it means for all of us. Bees, plastic waste, and the story behind it next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. James Brown also talked to Norman Jones. Tell listeners who he is.
Norman Jones is the commissioner of the Department of Environmental Services at the City of Rochester. He's been there forever.
And we're going to hear from him on the subject of community engagement.
Yes. He described the process of people and trying to serve a lot of masters at once.
Let's do that.
My grandson had a joke for me. He said, Granddad, how do you eat an elephant? And I said, how do you eat an elephant? He says, one bite at a time. So we started off one bite at a time. And the first bite is to just engage the community. From folks from Lewis Street, folks from Leonard Street, folks from Selden Place, folks from Grove Place, folks from St. Simon Terrace, the actual business community that's on St. Paul Street, the folks at Genesee Brewery. All these folks are stakeholders, the people at the YWCA. All these folks have an important role to play, and their message and their concerns are just as important as anyone. Everyone's going to be at the table. Everyone is valued, and that's why this process is so important, and that's why we started off with civic engagement and outreach as the first step before we start planning or doing anything in regards to how we envision this next phase or phase two of the Interloop development.
Specifically targeted citizen engagement. They didn't want to go widespread with it at all. They wanted to make sure that the neighbors and the people who live and work in that area got first say on whatever.
Okay. And so let me ask our guest again. Nancy, what do you make of what you just heard from the commissioner there?
I think that is wonderful news. That is something that we've been working towards and looking forward to doing, to sit around the table and be part of the process of what's going to come into our neighborhood and how it's going to affect our neighborhood and our voices being heard as a community. So I'm excited about that. You know, I'm only hoping that it's true and it's not something that they're just pulling a wool over our eyes and getting our hopes up high to finally hear our voices and then take advantage of the situation and build what they want to build anyway. But I'm excited that if he's honest and they want to sit us at the table, we're willing to be there and help and be part of the process.
What do you think, Suzanne Mayer?
I have to respect Mr. Jones. We've gone to him. Hinge Neighbors was formed to make sure that people were getting their opinions heard. And Sean Dunwoody and I went to talk with Mr. Jones, and we said, this is what we'd like to do. And they said, well, it's great that you can do the community involvement. And we've been working on that for, I would say, 3 years. So part of it is meeting with finding people such as Nancy who are willing to talk and get involved and say, yeah, we have to really go forward with this. And at first, people were saying, well, Hinge Neighbors, you tell them. And we were saying, no, that's not our job. Our job is to make sure that you tell them. So we've been trying to get presentations to both Bergman and the mayor and other city officials. And we've been fairly successful. I would say it's work. It's hard work. And sometimes we do get skeptical, I would say. But we just keep going on. And yesterday, I was serendipitous. We were walking down the street, doing live streaming with a tour of going across the Sio Street Bridge towards Nancy's neighborhood. And we were saying, for the school, we were saying, imagine going, you know, seeing all these buildings disappear, and now you have this that we're looking at. What are we going to do with it? And getting the students involved. And lo and behold, who stopped us and talked to us? What, Mr. Jones? And he said, yes, it's very important. And he said to the children, yes, it's important for our youth, not children, our youth, to be involved in what's going to happen to this, because they're going to live with it. So he's always open to listening to us, and for that, I do appreciate it.
Well, and so let me read two different emails, very different perspectives on what we saw in the eastern third of the Interloop, and when it comes to housing, what's appropriate, what's high-end, all that stuff. So Jason follows up to say, three entire new buildings along Union Street, from north of Shallott Street to Broad Street, are designated as affordable housing. Stop perpetuating the false narrative that the development associated with the Interloop East is all high-end. Now, we can debate what exactly affordable means. Whereas Ray writes to us to say, some people pay $200 a month. Well, how many of those apartments are $200 a month? For how long? Is it permanent affordability? Most of the East Interloop housing was sold to developers using investor-funded programs that want return on their profits. They want things to go market rate in 10 to 15 years. East Interloop $200 a month programs are token examples. This city needs over 20,000 units at city affordability to address gentrification and displacement. Talk of a similar approach for the northern part of the Interloop is more tokenization by City Hall and by developers looking to get land and profit from it. That's Ray Ray. I mean, James Brown, two very different takes on what we've already seen. I mean, it's like we're looking at one slice of reality and people see it two totally different ways there.
And I think that's unavoidable with a project like this. I think with most of the people who I spoke with on this, it is a bit of a funhouse mirror, depending on what perspective you come from. And I could totally see rationale in both their statements, both on the development on Union Street and in the idea of what exactly is affordable housing and how long it stays. We've seen it in other parts of the country where affordable housing doesn't stick, and we've seen it where it sticks, and it doesn't always work either way. So it's all up for debate, and I think we have to watch closely how any type of program like that is instituted in Rochester.
And I do want to say, as we hear from Nancy and Suzanne on this, that I think Ray Ray is raising an important point here. What does affordable really mean? Some of these terms are really amorphous, and sometimes a project will have, you know, a low sort of minimum threshold of quote-unquote affordable, where the rest of it is $1,100 a month, $1,200 a month, $1,600 a month, or $300,000 and up for townhomes. So, you know, when you meet that low threshold, you do that. And he's right. Sometimes they sunset it. And all of a sudden, 5, 10, 15 years down the line, there's nothing that's affordable. So I think it's fair for Ray Ray to point that out and say, we better know going in here what this is and what it is, not just in year one, but it looks like in year 10 and year 20. Nancy, what do you think?
Well, yes, I agree 100%. When they're talking about affordable homes, they're talking about affordable homes. They're talking rental units for people to rent out. Our main concern and what we want in our community is homes, separate single homes for families to be able to raise their children in a community, not apartments. We have enough of those already. And yes, it depends on who owns these buildings. And yes, most of the rents do go up. They say that we already have affordable housing, but the housings that we do have, and they claim that they're affordable, they start off with $600 and up. That's enough for you to be able to pay a mortgage on your own home and not share a space with people. Rental units are really difficult to live in, because you're sharing this space. It's not the same as having your own private home and sharing the space only with your family.
Let me ask Suzanne if she wants to weigh in on that as well. Go ahead, Suzanne.
I sure do. I think that a lot of that is we have to think about, maybe this is not all developer directed, that in fact, if you start at the federal level by thinking about different policies that you would have in there,
it then holds us all to keep it that way in the future. So I'm looking for long term. And I think that we have to reach out to places, what you're talking about, to find out how do they do this. And we need to influence that. One of the things that we have to very much look at is zoning. When you look at this, the intent is that this new area that's being dug is going to be called Center City zoning. And we know that that's why you have on the Interloop East, that's where you can build long, big houses. We're asking not so much that big houses are bad, but how can we be creative about our city being different from other places? If you talk to, if you travel around this, you know, the United States, you can see the, which I think that we have some nice attempts at building these big buildings, but they're not very creative and not differently designed. They look the same here as they do in Denver, as they do in a lot of the other cities doing the same thing. I would like to see our architects really think about how you can do this creatively and manage to do this. I think the new, and I think we have them in the United States. So I believe that you can't just leave it up to developers, that you really have to think about as a government entity to say, how do we do this? In New York, I would say that they wanted to have some parkland that was accessible along new land that was developed for housing and residential. While it's large things, they said, we need to have park space along the river, and we need to be able to have access to that park space. And that was built into anything the developers had to do. And in fact, the Parks Department did that. I think that we need to think about that. How can you be that creative in Rochester? We're certainly, we have all these schools here. We have access to learning from Chicago, from other places that have done some really wonderful, interesting things. The first part of this, though, recall, is this is how we're going to design our street. So that's the first part. And then the city then develops RFPs or requests for proposals from the developers. And we have to remember that at that point in time, we have to, who runs that? How do we influence that? And how do we do what Nancy's asking us to do? How do we provide housing where people can have single homes, build a community, and rebuild a community? There was a community, a wonderful community there. I love going there. I walk in the neighborhood. And I think that we can continue to build on it, to fill in the vacant lots with appropriate housing, so that's not destroyed before the Interloop even gets filled in. So we have two parts to think about. How do we worry about the vacant lots in the area? What's going to go in there? What goes in the Interloop? And then also you have Delavan Street along University. How does the University Street development affect School 58? How does it affect Grove Place? How do we keep our history? So the end.
Well, in our last 90 seconds, I'm going to ask James Brown a couple of things. First of all, HS emails me to say, Evan, will the RBTL get money to build a new theater there? They seem to be friends of the mayor. I tell you what, James, that's the first I've heard of that in a long time. I don't think that they're in the mix here, as far as I know.
I would doubt it.
Honestly, I don't even recall any discussion of a new RBTL project in a very long time. Ever since things fell apart at Parcel 5, they tried to move, and I don't think so.
They'd have the space for it.
They and speaking of the space, so in our last minute, speaking of the space here, James,
yep.
You mentioned earlier this is a much bigger area
mm-hmm.
than what we saw with the eastern third of the Interloop. So, you know, I know the mayor wants to be aggressive on a timeline, but realistically, we're seeing buildings built now. They started filling the eastern third of the Interloop 7 years ago. So we should probably be set to be pretty patient here, shouldn't we?
Absolutely. This is easily a, I'd say, 15-year project minimum. We're talking a massive, massive project that would take a ton of individual development. It would take bringing in a bunch of investors who are willing to build to whatever specs are given to them. So it's not something that would happen definitely in under a decade for sure. We're talking about a places where there are more challenges in terms of income, more challenges in terms of a landscape, and from what Norm Jones explained, more challenges in terms of infrastructure and getting the right energy resources for different parts of any kind of project. So absolutely, it's not going to be quick.
Your work on this is outstanding. No surprise there. And tell people where they can find it, James Brown.
Either on WXXINews.org or CityNews.org.
Rochester City News and City Magazine. Great stuff. Yep. Thank you, my friends. Great to see you here.
Great to see you too, Evan.
James Brown, reporter for WXXI News. Nancy Hernandez-Mashuska, good luck to you. I know we'll all stay in touch on this, but I'm really glad you're at the table with this, Nancy. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
You got it. Suzanne Mayer, president of Hinge Neighbors, I know you will keep at it. Keep in touch with us.
Thank you so much. It was an honor to be here with Nancy.
Wonderful to have both of you, and more connections coming up in a moment.